तत् भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तत् भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तत् भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स अपारुचादेसङ्गमथसथवराये सर्वान्धाबमुजन्तु सदा
left of this vata. The next observance day will be the pavarana. So this is my 35th vata nearly complete. So this is a convention, as reflected, this is a form that we use, the sense that I have 35 vatas. You know, if I said that to somebody that wasn't a Buddhist, they wouldn't know what I was talking about. So I've got 35 vatas. And I was a samanera for one vata before that, speaking a whole new jargon that and so the time, in the sense of, is there anyone that really has any vasas, or is this, you know, is there a real Ajahn Sumedho or Prasumedho that has 35 vasas that was a samanera and before that was a layperson? And so this is like questioning and reflecting, and it's so easy to assume all kinds of things from the memories that we hold and the conventions that we identify with. This word, like identify, is I like, because it's how we see, you know, we identify with the body. You know, the thing, we look at the body and say, this is mine. So that identity with it and with the memories, my vatas, when I was this or that, then this whole sense of a self arises, of being a person. Being American, you know, or that's identity with a, that's just a perception, isn't it? That's a convention. Is there really anything to be American here? You know, the question is the body American, or is the memory? You know, I have a memory, a perception. So the identity is with that word American. So it's an empty form, isn't it? When you really investigate it, there's nothing to it, really. Because at this moment there's nothing, there's no core, there's no heartwood, there's no solid center, or no essence, or no substance. It's merely like foam, bubbles, our identities. And so it's like dreams or illusions that this realm that we identify with and we hold to as reality is really illusory. And so our dream world, when we go to sleep and we dream, is are they less real than this dream right now? Because when you're dreaming, they seem real enough. This seems real enough, and if I go into the, if I identify with it. But if I reflect on it, this reflective ability, is that awareness. Noticing the way it is, then the reality, then there's reality, there's awareness and consciousness, there's intelligence, but it's not identified with. I make no identity. I don't call it mine. It's not personal. So it's learning to say, recede, go out of that turning wheel, to get yourself off the wheel into the center, into the still point, to where the that which you can't get beyond. So how do you find, how do you know that? It's through this awareness, like in this retreat, and all our life now as samanas, they are the purpose of our taking on this form, Buddhist monastic form. What are you doing it for? You know, what is it? What is your intention? You know, to create more illusions, and to identify, or to use it as a expedient means, something, a tool, with a skillful means or expedient means that encourages this awareness, this awakened state, attention, reflecting on the way it is. It could be rather scary because emotionally we can feel very threatened now because of this impending sense of war in the world, and the way everything is kind of winding itself up to have a big war against evil, the terrorists. Now we've got an enemy, and it's the terrorists, and this is kind of thrilling, kind of it's exciting to the emotional, to our emotions. That's also threatening, but in many ways, on the level of our illusions, this goes along with the way we, the illusions we have in life, isn't it? How we're kind of programmed to think in terms of enemies. Good and evil, right and wrong, and this sense of what's good. We're on that side of what's right. We don't identify ourselves as terrorists. I am a terror. I identify with being a terror. Maybe they should come and shoot me down. A terrorist. Another. They don't even pronounce it. They pronounce it terrorist, generally. So this is the thing of, we don't identify that. The United States, they don't think of themselves as terrorists, even though they terrify a lot of people. The way they blasted Serbia, and continually, I hear they're constantly bombarding Iraq. You know, they never get Saddam Hussein. He's too clever. They just get kind of innocent bystanders. And the ones who aren't terrorists. And yet, they call them fighting for right and for the law and for what's just. And freedom. And so this is, and then the terrorists, they're fighting for the purity of Islam or whatever, some kind of convictions they have in regards to their particular position. Both probably coming from very strong sense of we are right, you're wrong. And of course we can demonize, it's easy to demonize, you know, in the Western press to make the kind of Middle Eastern, when you see a Middle Eastern person now, you know, and we can demonize them so that, you know, they're all, you know, potential terrorists with some kind of horrible weapons and intention to destroy us, to destroy our security, our sense of safety, the sense of ourself, our goodness, our society, freedom, our religion, democracy, all its good, American values, justice and liberty and happiness and all the rest. They want to take it away from us. And so then we can, you know, we all we can feel when we get caught into that way of thinking is, you know, we've got to really fight against them, protect ourselves from these horrible people. And they no doubt create the same delusion around us. So, I mean, who's right and who's wrong? And then you get into another fight, you know, where, you know, each one can totally convince the other is wrong. But when you look at it through reflection, it's all an illusion, isn't it? You know, is there anyone, any person, any condition that is absolutely right and or absolutely wrong, or is can right and wrong and good and bad be absolute? Are the prerogative good? Is the prerogative of us, the Western democracies, and wrong is the way those Islamic fundamentalists are, those Middle Eastern people, those Arabs, those Muslims? And on like this. When you dissect it, when you put it, really look at it in terms of the way it is now, there's nothing to it. It's foam on the sea. It's soap bubbles. And yet this is how we can get ourselves completely caught up into these illusions. To sacrifice our life for an illusion. To try to protect our identities, our positions, our territory. Isn't it? We're very territorial. So we think this England here belongs to the English. When we take that apart, does this plot of land here say it's England? You know, does that earth, when I walk Joan Grove, stand outside and the earth comes up and says, you're walking on me, England? Never said that, ever. But I say, I'm walking here in England, and I'm the one that's calling it England. And that is an identity, a conventional identity. Isn't it that we all agree to call this plot of land here in England? But it's not really that. It is what it is. And yet we'll fight over it, isn't it? We'll fight to, you know, we'll torture, we'll commit the most atrocious acts over territory. Quibble about, you know, 1 inch of property on a border. Or like Israel, you know, they're fairly convinced that God, gave Israel to the Jews. It doesn't belong to those Palestinians, because God gave it, you know, how many years ago, 3,000 years ago or something, to the Jews. So it's their land. So then they all agree to look at it like that, and so then they have a power behind that belief, around that illusion. When you pick it apart, there's nothing to it. It's nothing. You can't. That the land doesn't belong to anybody. It is what it is. Can I claim, even though I can, if I own land, I legally, you know, I buy a plot of land and they say this legally in the law book, this belongs to Ajahn Sumedho. Doesn't really. That's just the convention. Our belief in the legal system is something to depend on. So when we bind ourselves to these conventions and these illusions, then of course we're in for trouble, because these are so unstable and not in a line with Dhamma, so that we end up, you know, wasting our lives around trying to increase the sense of identification, to increase the sense of it's mine and it belongs to me, and I want to protect it. I want to hand it down to future generations. On and on like this into the sense of future lives or the generation that follows. And we create the whole realm of illusion and personality and identity with the perceptions that we create in our mind, which arise and cease, which have no real core to them, no essence. And yet, we can be very threatened when these illusions are threatened. Remember, first, questioning the reality of my personality scared me to death. When I started questioning overly confident, high self-esteem, I'd never been prone towards seeing myself in kind of megalomaniac perception. Usually the opposite, very critical, self-critical. But even then, I felt very threatened when that security of that confidence in being this screwed up personality was being threatened. Because there is a stability, even, you know, like you find people that are identified with kind of illnesses or negative things, like alcoholics, or being identified with some kind of mental disease, like a paranoia or a passive aggressive personality or schizophrenic. Or whatever. These give us a sense of we know what we are, and we can justify the way we are, because we can say, I can't help the way I am. I'm a schizophrenic or whatever, and that gives us a sense of allowing us to be a certain way. And maybe a sense of confidence or stability in the fact that we, you know, our identities are labeled, and we all agree to look at you in this way, with this label, with this perception. So you realize the kind of courage it takes to question, to allow the illusory world that we've created to kind of fall apart. You know, like a nervous breakdown or something, you know, where the world falls apart. The security it offered, the safety, the confidence that we gain from that illusion starts cracking, falling apart. It's very frightening. And yet, within us, there's something that guides us through it. You know, what brings us into this life, into monastic life usually, is some intuitive sense. A sense behind the sense, an intelligence behind all the knowledge and cleverness of our minds. And yet we can't claim it on a personal level, isn't it? We always have to let go of the personal perceptions. Because as soon as we claim it, you know, like I am the all absolute, or that, then on this level of personality, you know, then we're creating another illusion again. So instead of claiming or identity or attachment. We began to recognize, to realize, or recognize the way it is. That's where this practice of awareness, satisampajanya, paying attention, being, in other words, it's going to the center point, to the position, the Bhutto position, the Buddha position. Like this Buddha image, and it's the still point. If you look at this Buddha Rupa, that's a symbol. That's an image representing the human form in the still point. So then, the encouragement to, in what we call meditation, this word meditation, could mean all kinds of things. It's a kind of word that includes any kind of mental practices, good or bad. But when I use this word, it's mainly what I'm using it for is that. Centering, that sense of establishing, going, resting in the center. And the only way that one can really do that, you can't do it if you think about it and try to analyze it. You have to trust in just a simple act of attention, of awareness. And it's so simple and so direct that our complicated minds get very confused. What are you talking about? I don't see any still point. I've never found a still point in me. When I sit and meditate, there's nothing still about it. But there's an awareness of that. Even if you think you've never had a still point, or you're a really confused, messed up character that really can't meditate. Trust in the awareness of that very perception. And that's why I encourage, you know, whatever you think you are, to think it deliberately. You know, if you what the kind of perceptions you have of yourself, so that they're not just kind of habitually kind of going through, and you're just trying to believing them or trying to get rid of them. Because the more we try to get rid of our personalities,
the more confused we get. If you assume you've got to get rid of your personality in some way, because it's an illusion, then you're caught in another illusion, that I'm someone who has a personality that I got to get rid of, so I'm the personality that's got to get rid of my personality. Get nowhere, isn't it? Ridiculous. So it's not a matter of getting rid of, but of knowing. So be a personality then, really, intentionally be a take it to absurdity. That's a lot of fun. Take your personality to where it's totally absurd, and listen to it so that your relationship is not one of identity, but of recognizing this is, I'm creating this personality. This is a changing condition. I can't create any kind of personal perception that lingers or stays. There's nothing that I can create through my mental power that has any staying power on a personal level. It's all very illusory, very changing, very ephemeral. Then that which is aware of the personality, I deliberately think, I am a screwed up person that needs to meditate in order to become enlightened in the future. I think that. But I'm listening to it. I'm deliberately thinking it. And I'm investigating it. So I've created that perception. Something like, it's not, you know, I've chosen to think that, and I can hear myself thinking it. That which is aware and listens to that perception, I don't create. It's not a creation, is it? I create this perception, but that which is aware of it, of this perception. So you can investigate, begin to know the difference between awareness and thinking. What is the still point, the center, the point that includes? So this kind of thinking is reflective, isn't it? I'm just asking myself this question to bring attention to this. I'm not looking for an answer in terms of somebody to give me an answer to that question, but that's a reflective question that brings my attention. It helps me to focus, to be aware. And the more I pay attention, where then, the more I recognize in this still point there's this resounding sound of silence. And I didn't create that. It's not a creation of mine. It's not like, I can't claim sound of silence is some kind of personal creation of mine. Belongs to Ajahn Sumedho. Like trying to claim the air or the space. It all belongs to me, all the space in the world. This is like a ridiculous thing. So the person, you know, you can't create a person around it. You can only be the sense of being. This still point, resting, opening,
And allowing the personality, the body, the emotional habits that arise, the thoughts that we have, our relationship to them now is understanding or embracing rather than identifying. You know? As soon as we identify with it, you know, think of, we have a negative thought, and then we, it hooks us. You know? I feel some negative feeling, and there I go again, being critical and negative about somebody, and I shouldn't do that, and I've been a monk all these years, and how can I stop doing that? And, well, I've lost it, isn't it? I'm back in the, I've identified with a negative thought, and it triggers off all kinds of feelings of despair, or I shouldn't be like this. I shouldn't think like this. A good monk should love everybody. And then you suddenly stop that. There's a back in the center again. So you recognize that it's no matter how many times you go out on the wheel, it's just a very simple act of attention to be back in the center. It's not a state, you know, it's not that difficult or remote or precious. We're just not used to it. We're used to being on the turning wheel. We're used to going around and around and becoming all kinds of things. We're used to that. We're used to delusions, fantasies, dreams. We're used to extremities. And so what we're used to is we incline to do that. If we're not attentive, if we're not vigilant, then we easily fall back into the turning wheel because we're used to that. And even though we suffer in that turning wheel, we're used to it. So, you know, when we aren't aware, say we aren't vigilant, attentive, then we easily fall back into the realm of suffering. But then the good side of it is that the more we develop awareness, cultivate this awareness, then those habits, the things that we're used to, we start, you know, the kind of deprogramming. We're not feeding those illusions anymore. We're not believing, we're not following, we're not resisting, we're not making any problem about the body as it is, or the memories, or the thoughts, or the habits, or the personality we have. We're not judging or condemning or praising or adulating or exaggerating anything. It is what it is. So, and as we do that, then our identity with it begins to slip away. We no longer seek identity with our illusions. We've broken through that. We've seen through that illusion of self, what we think we are. And then our inclination is towards this center point, this Bhutto, this Buddhist, Buddha position. So trusting this, if you know, it's something you can really trust. That's why I keep saying this, because just encouraging
Because a part of us doesn't trust, you know, when you think about it, you don't trust it. Or, you know, you can get very confused. Because other people will say other things, and you'll hear all kinds of opinions and views about meditation and Buddhism and all that. So, and within the Sangha, there's so many monks, nuns, and so many views and opinions. So it's a matter of learning to, you know, not get, you know, learning to trust yourself, the ability to be aware, rather than think, well, I'm not good enough to really trust myself. I've got to develop the jhanas first. I've got to purify my sila first. I've got to get rid of my neurotic problems and my traumas first before I can really meditate. And if you believe that, then that's what you'll have to do. But if you begin to see what you're doing, you know, that very illusion, and you can trust in that, just the simple recognition. It's not even condemning the illusion. It's not even saying you shouldn't do those things. I'm not saying you shouldn't purify your sila or resolve your emotional problems, go to therapy or whatever. I'm not saying you shouldn't do any of these things, or you shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't develop the jhanas. I'm not making any statement about should or shouldn't, but pointing to something you can trust of the awareness that sati sampatanya here and now. Now, if I should say, if one of you should come to me and say, Ajahn Sumedho, I'm really screwed up. I was very badly treated when I was a child, and I've got so many neurotic problems and fears, and I need to, you know, really, you know, go to therapy and get these things straightened out in some way, because I can't really meditate the way I am. And I say, well, yeah, you should. You know, you're really screwed up. And I think you should go to a therapist and straighten yourself out first, and then meditate after that. Would that be very helpful? Would I be pointing to the still point? Or would I be perpetuating your own self-view? Even that view might be right on a worldly limb, not saying you shouldn't. So this is, I feel the best, not to tell you, you know, like say, you are this way or that way, you know, not to give you some kind of identity to attach to, but to kind of empower you or encourage you to trust in your own ability to wake up, to pay attention. Then that, you know, whether you the result of that, I don't know. I mean, I'm hoping it'll be, you know, a good one. But it's true, you know, it's not, your true identity isn't with any condition. You know, pointing to the present, the Pachubana Dhamma. Now that, then we grasp that idea, so then we think, we don't need to do all those things. We don't need to be monks or nuns. We don't need therapy. We don't need And, you know, we can just meditate. The pure meditation will solve all our problems, and then we grasp that. And so then we become, you know, we become anti-religion. I think all religion is a waste of time. Psychotherapy is a waste of time. You don't need it. All you need to do is be mindful and meditate. And we grasp that view. That's another viewpoint, isn't it? So that's not pointing at, you know, that kind of opinionating. Those kind of opinions are not pointing at the center, are they? They're judging the conventions or the conditions again, saying you don't need religion, you don't need, it's all a bunch of rubbish. And even though you can say that's true, you know, ultimately, all you need is just to wake up. Simple as that. But that in itself, that what I've just said is the convention of language. And so this is where this empowerment or this encouragement is pointing to an imminent act of awakening, not to tell you as some kind of person, you're asleep and you should wake up. Or that you should grasp that idea, but that sense of actually being there. Now, in the Western world, we get very complicated because we don't have a lot of saddha, usually, in this. You know, when we become samanas, the Asian Buddhists, they tend to have culturally more attuned to this. They have a lot of faith, oftentimes in Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and in a teacher or something like this, where we come to Buddhism, most of us, when we're adults, and we're skeptical. Usually we've gone through a lot of skeptical doubts and strong self-images, hard, strong sense of individuality. Now, I mean, speaking for myself, it's, you know, my personality was a doubting, skeptical one. So doubt, this vicikicca was a really, you know, it was one of my greatest obstructions. Doubting. And that's why I couldn't be a Christian, because I couldn't believe in what I was supposed to believe in. I just had not my totally impossible for me to believe in the kind of doctrine that you have to believe in to be a Christian. Skeptical, doubting character. And also, at the age of 32, was quite cynical. Had been through a lot, had a lot of bitterness about life, disappointments. I was not pleased with my life at 32, and I was disappointed with myself and a lot of others and the world. I mean, there was a kind of despair, a bitterness, and doubt, and yet there was the faint light at the end of the tunnel was in Buddhism. There was one thing that still I could still had some hope for, and that was I was interested in Buddhism. And so that was a sign to me of where I started. I had something, some kind of sign that drew me into this life. But then the good thing about being highly individualistic and skeptical and doubtful is you do tend to question everything. You know, the sacred, that which is sacred, and never question oftentimes in religions. We're allowed to be questioned. You know, one thing I appreciated with Lung Po Cha was everything was up for questioning. You know, he was never one to a peremptory approach of you have to believe in this and you have to believe in that. And there was never that hard, heavy-handed, dictatorial style. It was much more this reflective, you know, questioning, inquiry. But one of the problems with Westerners is that we're complicated because of the lack of faith. Our identities get so complicated in so many ways with highly personal. Like we take everything personally. Sexual desire, isn't it? The sexual force in the body is regarded as very personal. Even hunger, like, and thirst. Hunger for food, we identify with it in a very personal way. And the basic forces that are just natural, we take on and judge them personally. So we can feel very guilty about having sexual desires, because we're even having sexual organs, or sexual bodies, or being hungry. You know, I've seen monks feel guilty about being hungry because they see it as greed. Greedy. Or the negative side, getting angry or jealous. These are disgusting. We shouldn't be angry. We shouldn't get angry. We shouldn't be jealous. We shouldn't be brave. We shouldn't be cowardly and weak, pusillanimous. And we've got, so we get very complicated because we judge ourselves endlessly, criticize ourselves according to maybe very high standards, very ideal, noble standards, and that we can never live up to. So we get very self-disparaging and neurotic and depressed because we're not in touch with nature. You know, we've come from the world of ideas rather than realizing the natural laws. So in meditation is recognizing the way it is, the Dhamma, the natural law, the way things are. That sexual desire is like this, it's not mine. The body is like this, it's a sexual body, so it's going to have these energies. It has sexual organs. It's made like this. This is the way it is. So it's not personal. They didn't create it. So we begin to look at just the kind of most obvious things, the basics, the human body, in terms of the way it is rather than identifying with it personally. Hunger and thirst are like this, and we get into the instinctual energy, survival, isn't it? We have strong survival instincts, procreative instincts, like hunger and thirst, survival, protect ourselves, need for safety. We all need to feel some kind of physical safety, which is, you know, survival instinct. These are basic to the animal kingdom, not just the human. And then it gets more complicated because we identify with it and judge it according to very high standards, ideals. Then we become neurotic, you know, it gets all over the place. Can't do anything right. And this complicated mess that we create in our lives, very confusing. So it is the time now to see that this needn't be seen in terms of even no matter how complicated it is, the practice is very simple. So this is where we do need a lot of patience, because when we're very complicated, we oftentimes lack patience with ourselves. Because we've got clever minds, we think very quickly, and we have strong passions, and it's so easy to get lost in all this, and it's very, you know, confusing for us, because we don't know how, we don't have any way out of it, we don't know a way to transcend or to see it in perspective. So what I'm pointing to this center point, to this still point, to the here and now, is pointing away the way of transcendence, or the escape from it. Not escape by running away out of fear, but the escape hatch that allows us to get perspective on the mess, on the confusion, on the complicated self that we've created and that we identify with. So it's very simple, and it's not complicated. But if you start thinking about it, then you can make it very complicated. Well, I don't know if I can do that. and then another complication takes place. But that's where this trust. This is, I don't know if you're aware that that's just a perception in the present. I don't think I can ever realize nirvana. It's a perception in the present. Trust in that. That's all you need to know. It is what it is, you know. We're not saying, we're not judging even that perception. We're not saying, what a stupid perception. Don't add anything. It is. And that awareness of it, that's what I'm pointing to, the awareness. Learn to trust in that awareness rather than in the what the perception is saying. Even the perception might be common sense in a way, but the attachment to it is where you get lost in it. And we can have very, you know, we should practice meditation. We should, you know, not be selfish, and we should, you know, learn to be more disciplined and more responsible for our lives. That's very good, you know, good advice. But then if I attach to that, what happens? Then I go back and thinking, I'm not responsible enough, I've got to become more responsible, and I need to, I shouldn't be selfish, You know, I'm too selfish and I shouldn't be. And I'm back into the turning wheel again. Like, it just goes on, you know. One gets so intimidated by even the best advice. So what to do? And so then this is trust in the awareness of it. And then I should be responsible is then is seen, and then and runs relationship to it is no longer grasping it. And maybe if that resonates as something to do, then be more responsible or whatever. But it's not like denying or blotting out or condemning or believing, but trusting in the attitude of attention and awareness, rather than endlessly trying to sort it out on the turning wheel with all its complicated thoughts and habits, where you just get dizzy and get totally confused. But you see, in the still point, it gives you perspective, you know, on the conditions, on the turning wheel, on the confusion, on the mess. It puts you in a relationship to it, is the knowing of it for what it is, rather than some kind of personal identity with it. So then you can see your true nature is this knowing, this pure state, pure consciousness, pure awareness. You're learning to remember that, to be that. Your real home, what you really are, rather than what you think you are, according to the conditioning of your mind. So I'll stop here, and then this is, we can have the traditional midnight vigil. All invited to participate, and then whatever you do, then just be fully aware of what you're doing, you know. And you know, I don't even care if you stay till midnight, you know, but. To be aware of what you're doing, if you really trust in that, then that would be praiseworthy. But only you know, isn't it? You know, nobody, whether you can praise yourself or not. Oh, that's all I'll say this evening.